We're going to do a series that the church had recommended, and that's why you might see a couple of visitors in the class today, called Culture and Church. And it's really just kind of a look at this issue of cultural captivity. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Colossians, and we're going to just look at a couple of verses today. Next week, we're going to look at this entire passage. And so just as Pastor Graham has been working his way through the Psalms, and wasn't this wonderful worship experience today? Wasn't that something? And those of you that the ladies that had a chance to get the CD ahead of time with Beth Moore, that was pretty amazing too. Now everybody else has been able to get those. And we're going to look at Colossians 2, verses 6 through 8. Next week we're going to finish the entire passage, but we're going to look at this idea today. And in Colossians 2 here, Paul is writing to the church in Colossae, and he says, "Therefore, as you receive Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him, rooted and built up in him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, abounding in thanksgiving." He goes on to say, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elementary spirits of the world, and not according to Christ." And in some respects, there's a very strong correlation between what we'll be talking about here today and this morning and what we've been doing in the Bible study. And those of you that did not have a chance to come to the Bible study last week, you're welcome to come tonight. I'll talk more about that in just a minute. But a lot of what I'm going to share has to do with this idea of cultural captivity. Matter of fact, that is found in this particular book called Cultural Captives, written by one of our staff members at Probe Ministries, in which we've really looked at this idea of cultural captivity. And cultural captivity obviously looks different in Asia or Africa than it does in the United States, but most of the studies we've looked at really do show that most Christians, a very significant majority of Christians, even in America, are culturally captive. And so what I want to try to do for just a few minutes, as you can see in your handout there, is summarize just a few things out of this book. Itself is a whole presentation, but I really wanted to just take a few of those ideas. And for those of you that are new in the class, if you look at the handout there, you'll notice I'm going to follow along in the handout, but at the very bottom, you will notice that it says PrestonWoodExamine.org. And that means that if you would like to find some of this material in the future, it is available on that website. Some of you that have a smartphone or a tablet, you actually can go there right now and follow along. So if you find yourself saying, "Ooh, that was a good statistic," or "That was something I'd like to know a little bit more about," or "I'd like to refresh my memory or pass that on to someone else," let me just mention that all of that can be really found very easily on that website. And Parker has been very good over the years of putting those there so you can find other presentations. We'll even add the audio to it later on, so you'll have that opportunity. And what I want to try to do is look at this issue of cultural captivity, because it's one of the reasons why we have put together the Periscope Bible study that we are doing every Sunday night. It's one of the reasons Pro Ministries has been making this available to churches and small groups and things like that. But let's, if we can, look at some of the facts and figures. And that is, you know, some commentators argue that, you know, we do have a problem in America, but they don't think there's any cause for concern. Yes, the younger generation seems not to necessarily hold to biblical values. We see almost two-thirds of all young people by the time they graduate from high school leave the church, but they're going to be like the swallows to Capistrano. They're going to come back again, you know, and all the questions that people have about biblical orthodoxy, those aren't necessarily going to be long-lasting. And so what I want to try to do for a few minutes is summarize a number of studies. There is what has been done nationally. There's what is known as the National Study of Youth and Religion. And I might mention, if you want to read more about that, maybe that's one of the books we could make available to our visitors as well. That is available. There are also a series of research studies that were done by a man by the name of Christian Smith, who's at Notre Dame, books like Souls in Transition, all the way to his latest book, Lost in Transition, in which he has this entire group of individuals that he has followed in what you would call a longitudinal study from when they were in high school to now as young adults, and has certainly documented some of that. There's been some good research that was done at Baylor University, so I'll also maybe refer occasionally to the Baylor Religion Study. And then the group that I'm with, Probe Ministries, we spent a lot of money, a number number of years ago working with the Barna Group. By the way, George Barna is going to be on my radio program Thursday, in case any of you want to tune in to that as well. But nevertheless, and this was perhaps the most extensive survey ever done of born-again evangelical millennials. And so when we began in this book to try to compare these various studies, you had a lot of people saying, well, things aren't as bad as you've heard. And you can see, for example, that when you look at those surveys, about 80% of young Americans say they believe in God. Now, when you go back and ask what they mean by God and what their view is, you can begin to see there's some real problems. But when you really begin to ask additional questions to determine whether those same individuals have a biblical worldview, that percentage drops pretty significantly to about a third or less, depending on your survey. You can see that the national study had 22%, Baylor had 27%, even Probe had 37%. And, of course, they don't ask exactly the same kind of questions. But as we've tried to look at these different surveys, we recognize that if you didn't really dig into the data, lots of times you will have individuals saying, well, it's just not that bad. And there was a good article in Christianity Today that was making the case that even though there is some cause for concern about where America is going, and certainly we recognize the younger generation don't seem to be in church as often, and they don't seem to have as many biblical ideas, this is not a major problem. And when we really took the time to get down to the studies, compare question to question. This took an enormous amount of time, but Steve Cable's a National Merit Scholar, and he's the kind of person just gets into the research, and we just slide food under the door and just keep him, you know, keep him working on these things. We came to some very striking conclusions. And in the interest of time, before we get into some of the things about the millennials, let me just mention that there are three trends that if you wanted to take some notes, you might want to put down. And the first is that we recognize that as the culture has adopted more unbiblical views. You would accept that, wouldn't you? You know, the Christian consensus that used to exist in America isn't there. So as the culture has adopted more unbiblical views about sex, marriage, pluralism, honesty, things like that, we find that a majority of evangelical church members have oftentimes adapted to accept kind of these new cultural positions rather than to really stand firm on biblical principles. And so if nothing else, that I think illustrates the verse I just put there for you in Colossians 2:8. They've been willing to be taken captive by empty deception and philosophy according to the traditions of men, according to the elementary principles of the world rather than according to Christ. If you're taking some notes, you could put in addition to Colossians 2:8, you could put down Romans 12:1 and 2, where it says, we are not to be what? Conformed to this world. And so we have a lot of evidence that suggests that actually, as the culture has moved, oftentimes the church has as well. And here's a kind of a visual illustration. As the culture has strayed, Christians have sort of followed along, but there's sort of been a lag time. In other words, we're no different than where the culture was sometimes, where it was 10 years ago. We always look a little bit better as a culture as it goes downhill, but you should hope that we would be doing this. And there are some very striking exceptions to that general trend. Those tend to be in Bible-teaching churches. Those tend to be in Christian schools that teach Christian worldview. There are some great places where you can point out the contradiction to that general trend, but the first trend we find is as the culture has adopted some of these unbiblical views, the church oftentimes has adapted to it as well. The second trend is simply this, and that is it's very easy to illustrate with these various surveys, the National Survey, the Baylor Survey, and some of the others, and the Christian Smith Survey, that the millennial generation, those born between 1980 and 2000, are leaving the evangelical faith in large numbers. Now, when they leave in two different ways. Sometimes they leave, say, maybe a Bible-teaching church, an evangelical church, to say like a mainline church, which is more liberal, or in some cases they just simply leave the church altogether. But it is pretty easy to demonstrate that this break that oftentimes young people take between high school and whether they go in the military, whether they go to college or whatever, is continuing on and doesn't seem to be reversing necessarily. The third is the percentage of Americans belonging to evangelical churches has remained somewhat the same. So the numbers still look pretty good, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the beliefs are that way. In other words, because some of these churches have adapted to the culture, they might still have the numbers, they still might look pretty good at that point, but in, again, you can see that that is not being demonstrated by what they believe. Pastor Graham set me up pretty good for today, because one of the things that has come from Lifeway, which is kind of the research arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, is as they have looked at Baptist churches around the country, Southern Baptist churches, they found that the number of people being baptized into the churches has decreased significantly. There's one outstanding exception. It's called Prestonwood Baptist Church, and a few others, by the way, I might mention. So the trend may be harder for us to see because baptisms are up here at First Baptist and Prestonwood Baptist and a few other places around the country or even around the Metroplex. But overall, the trend has been down. And not that baptism always is an indicator of what a person believes, but it certainly is at least one very easy, concrete statistic that you can look at. And so again, you can see that that is something that needs to be paid attention to. And it is interesting that one of the individuals that's now taken over a lot of the Barna research work is a man by the name of Dave Kinneman. And he, along with others, have written a number of books. One book is entitled Unchristian. And so this was a survey of people that aren't Christians and asked them, why is it you aren't considering going to church? And it was interesting to see all the arguments, you know, well, they're hypocritical, they're too political, those kinds of issues. And so that book really helped us understand why, in some respects, those who've been outside the church aren't necessarily coming to the church. And then, more recently, he's written another book called You Lost Me, looking at those who used to be in church and why they left the church, and how that has been another very significant issue. And so, obviously, you know, we're just talking about, we're going to have a marketing meeting here. Well, you know, whether you talk about marketing or branding or positioning or whatever, in some respects, you could honestly look at it from a secular point of view. The church is not perceived in a positive way by people either that have never been to church or were at church and have left the church. And so this is why we are starting to recognize some of the real concerns. With that, let me, if I can, then get to this issue of what I'll call the millennial generation. And just want to spend a few minutes on that and make sure that we end on time. But the first is to recognize that when we talk about the so-called millennial generation, we are, if I can use the demographics, talking about those born between 1980 and 2000. If you look at that, they are the largest generation in American history because there were actually, interestingly enough, 78 million millennials born between 1980 and 2000. Now, if you do an apples-to-apples comparison, the baby boom generation was the largest before that, 76 million, which is now 78 million because of immigration. That's from 1946 to 1964, which was not 20 years. So if you do a 20-year comparison, that's not quite the same. But we had this baby boom, and then we had kind of a baby bust or a birth dearth, and then we had a millennial baby boom echo, if you will. And so you've had that. And so today, what I want to try to do is look for just a minute at some of the mindset of those young people. These are the future leaders. Matter of fact, this week I had a chance to speak at Dallas Baptist University. I spoke in both the chapel and in the faculty. At the end, the newest president there at DBU referred to himself as a millennial. And I started to count it up and I go, yeah, I guess he was born in 1980. So now the president at Dallas Baptist University, replacing Gary Cook, who was the president all those years, who's more my age, is a millennial. So you have a millennial president leading the millennial kids at DBU. And you start realizing already some of the older millennials are already in positions of authority in business and in church and in missions and things of that nature. And so I want to pull from a few things. First of all, from Tom and Jess Rayner. They're with the Lifeway group in Nashville, which is kind of the research arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. And if you would like to know more about millennials, this book, written by Tom Rayner and his son, Jess Rayner, called Millennials, very good book. I'm also going to pull a little bit more from some of the other surveys we've mentioned, including one done by the Pew Research Center. So that gives you a little bit of kind of who they are from their demographics. But how do they think? Because if you want to attract people to Prestonwood Baptist Church, if you want to sell a product or a service to a millennial, it's important to understand not just their demographics, but their psychographics. The first is, this is a generation that's perhaps more diverse than any generation in American history. Matter of fact, as I go through this, you're going to say, well, I know some kids, or maybe I'm a millennial, and that doesn't describe me. Every trend has an exception because it's very diverse. They're also very diverse ethnically. 35% fit into the category non-white or Latino. So again, a much more diverse generation than we've ever had before. Probably as we see this playing out, will be the most educated generation in American history. If we look at those individuals in the millennial generation who, by the age of 25, have a college degree, they have a higher percentage of those with a college degree than any individual before. That's going to be important because they tend to be a little more well-educated, a lot more skeptical in terms of media, which we'll talk about in just a minute, and that's going to be important in terms of the outreach as well. Also very hopeful. When in the Lifeway survey, they asked, do you agree with the statement, I believe I can do something great? 96% agreed with the statement. I mean, this is the generation that's given you short-term missions, a Habitat for Humanity, True Love Waits, those kinds of things. See you at the poll. So in some respects, tend to be very hopeful. And also extremely relational. They want to communicate and connect, and oftentimes are the ones that have really made social media effective. Let's look at a few more. They also tend to be, as defined by a number of individuals, the narcissistic generation. This is a book by Gene Twenge and others that have written about this, soaring rates of self-obsession. They also tend, because of that, also to be less inhibited than previous generations about some of the intimate details of their lives, and also very pragmatic in terms of thinking about what works and focused on results. Whereas the previous generation, if they were in the church, would say, well, I'll be glad to give to a missionary and support what they're doing. They are a little more hands-on. They say, I want to go to the short-term mission. I want to go and do Habitat for Humanity. I want to go and feed the poor. I want to do something. I want to have some more involvement rather than just have you do it. I want to be involved, and I want to make sure that I'm giving to individuals and giving to ministries that actually work. How do they view marriage and family? Well, again, you can look at their parents, because the parents of millennials in many cases were baby boomers, and they themselves were raised maybe with a level of self-centeredness, and so they wanted things to be perfect for their children. But most importantly, we see that this is a generation that has shown a high level of parental involvement. You've heard the phrase helicopter parents, you know, helicopter flying around, or snowplow parents plowing the way for their kids. And so in some respects, they have been affected by that in very profound ways. But at the other extreme, you have a lot of individuals that grew up in a home where the family did not stay together. Single parent homes, divorced homes. So you have this real dichotomy even within the millennial generation and how they think and believe. They tend to view their parents as a very positive source of influence, unlike, say, baby boomers who tended to be somewhat anti-authoritarian. They have a much more positive attitude towards those who are elderly and those, obviously, who are their parents. They also tend to view marriage differently, and this is one of the most striking things which I think pastors are going to have to address in the future, and certainly we're going to have to address, because this is a generation that has gotten married much later in life. The median age for men getting married is 5 years later. Median age for women getting married is 5 years later as well. And so you have this growing kind of gap of singlehood that has really never existed before. Churches that want to reach out to the millennial generation better have a very good singles ministry, or singles and singles again ministry, because it's a very different kind of world as well. This creates some issues. One of which is when in the Lifeway survey they actually ask, would you live together before married? They found that 60% of millennials said yes. I mean, after all, you wouldn't buy a pair of shoes without trying them on. You wouldn't buy a car without, a test drive. And so this is something that is very different than something we've seen before. Also, when asked the question about same-sex marriage, interestingly enough, there was a statement there, I see nothing wrong with people of the same gender getting married. This Lifeway survey was done a couple of years ago before the legalization of same-sex marriage. Again, they found about 6 in 10 agreed. 40% agreed, 21% agreed somewhat. And I suspect that the next time Lifeway does this survey, that percentage will be even higher now that you have, in a sense, the legalization of same-sex marriage. And so as a result, probably the younger you are, the more likely you are to be accepting of the issue of homosexuality. So you can see that that's a different issue as well. One other one that I thought might be appropriate to point out is not only in terms of marriage and family, also this is a generation that perhaps more than any generation in American history has been very influenced by the media. Televisions have existed for decades, but now with internet and with smartphones and tablets and computers, this is a generation very, very different. And interestingly enough, when we talk about new digital advances, there are usually three groups of individuals, and those are individuals that are either early adopters, then the majority, and the laggards. Anybody have any idea of which group the millennials tend to fit into? That first one. They're in line with Parker getting the latest, iPhone, right? They're, whatever it might be. He's looking around, and actually some of the people in line with him are younger than him because they're all out there on that. When we ask how they communicate with one another, what's the number one reason? Texting, of course, and phones and email. Last Lifeway survey asked, how do you communicate with somebody who's not in your presence? I want to go back and ask the question, how do you communicate with somebody when they're in the same room with you? Because I've seen kids, texting with each other across the table, because of the way in which texting has become very important. One of the things that Tom and Jess Rayner in their book, The Millennials, talked about is if there's ever a generation that has been identified by a particular form of media, video is that. Which I thought was kind of interesting because when I think of video, I think gamers usually are boys, male, but more and more female gamers. And so this is a generation that has really in some respects been much more identified in terms of video games. And of course, if you're interested in this whole area at Probe Ministries, we did a week of radio programs on that just to talk about the fact that sometimes there are some benefits in terms of dealing with complex sets of decision making and different simulations. Sometimes hand-eye coordination. But of course, the biggest concern, which we've talked about a few weeks ago, is the whole issue of media addiction. And young people today, especially maybe the millennial generation, spend entirely too much time in front of a screen. It could be a TV screen, a computer screen, a video screen, whatever it might be. But nevertheless, that is, again, one of those characteristics that we see there as well. In the Lifeway survey, which again was done a few years ago, and again, I'd like to get it updated, but when they did it a few years ago, they found most millennials use a computer for work. The median was about 17 hours a week. Then we asked how much time do they spend on personal use, another 17 hours. So that makes up to about 34 hours, which means a typical millennial spends one-third of his or her waking hours in front of a computer. I got to believe that number is probably higher now because with the advent of smartphones and things like that, which tell me, if nothing else, if a church is going to reach out, what kind of website do you have? This is perhaps the most media-sophisticated generation ever. And so, in many cases, people evaluate your business, your company, or your church by what they find on the front door. And what's the front door? It's the website. And so that's going to be, I think, very key in the 21st century. When we ask about theology, and now I'm looking at millennials in general, in just a minute we're going to look at born-again millennials, when asked to describe themselves, two-thirds use the term Christian. What does that mean? Probably absolutely nothing. It means I was born in America, didn't kill anybody. But, that was the phrase they used, Christian versus Buddhist, Hindu, whatever. But here's the interesting thing. The fastest growing demographic group of the millennial generation are what are called the nones, N-O-N-E-S, none of the above. Those who picked atheism, agnosticism, or no preference. That percentage right now is nearly 3 in 10, 28% when that was done. Now it's getting closer and closer to almost 35%. So you see that you are dealing with perhaps a more secular generation than ever before. About 20% could be termed born again, a smaller percentage could be defined evangelical. But here, back to the witnessing issue. You know, we were talking about what Todd is providing for us in terms of evangelism. A full third of these millennials actually said that no one can know what will happen when they die. That's a great evangelistic opportunity, isn't it? Wouldn't you like to know with certainty what would happen when you would die? Wouldn't you like to know for certain that you would go to heaven? So in some respects, there's still an openness for evangelism, if we're willing to go to them. And in terms of the church, of course, we see church attendance has been decreasing over time. Nearly two-thirds rarely or never attend religious services. They don't go to church or synagogue or mosque or anything. They don't sometimes know people that do. And one of the members of our class, who's not with us now, she went on to Nashville, but she used to teach at the Dallas Art Institute. And she told us the story a couple of years ago about how when she's oftentimes teaching them about art, she will also take them into buildings to teach about architecture. And oftentimes when she will take the class into a church, many of the students will say, "This is the first time I've ever been in a church." You know, think about that. So they are not coming from a churched background in many cases, or maybe some of them were in church once, but it's just a much more foreign experience. We see about one-fourth of millennials are active in church. That means that some of those individuals that are in church are seekers. They're not really born again, but they're in that church opportunity. And here was something interesting from our Barna survey that Probe Ministries did. We found a percentage of non-attenders have a biblical worldview. When I spoke the other day at Dallas Baptist University, afterwards I had all sorts of students ask questions, but one of the students asked a question, interestingly enough, were there ever any individuals that had a born-again experience who had a biblical worldview that weren't in church? And I said, yeah, it turns out to be about 4% in our survey. Now, you have to understand why some of that may be the case. If you go to the corners of the country, every year, for example, Suzanne and I get to go to Vermont and New York. In Vermont, there are fewer people by percentage who go to church in that state than any other state. You can walk through whole towns and not find anything that even looks like an evangelical church. If you're a born-again Christian with a Christian worldview, trying to find a church is really difficult. In a couple of weeks, Suzanne and I are going to go to Oregon. Oregon used to be number 50th on the list. Now it's 49th. But again, very few people by percentage in Oregon go to church, and even a smaller percentage go to an evangelical church. There aren't so many. And when I tell these people that we have a traffic jam at noon here, they can't even get their heads around the fact that we have a traffic jam Sunday at noon in Dallas, but we do. So you can see why some of them fit into that category as well. Well, on the end, let me, if I can, then go to the survey we did at Probe, and it'll also illustrate again why we are doing this Periscope program, not only for us here, but why we really want to make this available to people around the country. And then next week, we're going to look at, as we go back into Colossians 2, how is it that people are being taken captive? What are the philosophies and the ideologies that are so dominating our world today, and how can we as Christians respond to those? But anyway, again, our survey that we did was through the Barna Group. It was the largest survey ever done of kind of the leading edge millennials, somewhere even in the baby buster category. Very discouraging because, as I pointed out, we have about 70% from the nationwide surveys of 18 to 22-year-olds who take a break from college when they leave home. They go into the business world, they go into the military, they go into church, and they leave the church. And the question is, are they going to come back? And the question, I think, is a good one because there's good evidence that maybe they will not. Well, the first issue is I mentioned this idea of worldview, and a lot of people say, well, how can you really determine if a person has a worldview? Well, George Barna, who's been doing this for decades, has six questions that he asks to determine whether or not a person has a biblical worldview. Now, if you look at this, you're going to say this is really kind of basic theology. But well, what you will see in just a minute is that on one or more of these six questions, a number of individuals cannot agree with that. The first is that there's a God is all-knowing, all-powerful, creator of the world, and still rules the universe today. Number two, that Jesus Christ lived a sinless life on earth. Number three, that a person cannot earn their way into heaven by trying to be good or doing good works. Number four, the Bible is totally accurate in all its principles. Number five, absolute moral truth exists. And number six, Satan is considered to be a real being or force. As we'll see in just a minute, what happens is when you ask evangelicals this question, even these are evangelical millennials, born-again evangelical millennials, as you get down to questions 4, 5, and 6, they begin to say, no, I really don't believe that. And so what we found in our survey, this most extensive survey ever done of born-again millennials, is that really about one-third of them have a biblical worldview and attend church regularly. That means they go to church at least 2 out of every 4 weeks. Then you have one-third that do not have a biblical worldview, but they still attend church. And then one-third that have no biblical worldview and no church attendance. And, of course, I gave you that other one of a few that have a Christian worldview. But basically, it was kind of one-third, one-third, one-third. Now, what was so interesting is what it illustrated is, what's the difference? What is the difference between those that have a biblical worldview and those who don't have a biblical worldview? And what we found is if you began to ask the right questions, you began to understand exactly what the watershed is. And this is why, interestingly enough, those of you that were in the Bible study last week, we spent some time talking about an eternal perspective. If you have an eternal perspective, that seems to be everything. That is one of the big issues. If you say that I am not only living here, but I'm going to live for eternity, and what I do today echoes through eternity, what I do today has an impact in eternity, that is the case. And it also illustrated something else, that a biblical worldview is a lot more important than church attendance. You probably heard people say this, if I can just get that person in church, it will change everything. But we found that being in church isn't as important as having a biblical worldview. Remember, I talked about these people have a biblical worldview and are in church. These people don't have a biblical worldview, but they're still in church. And these people don't have a biblical worldview and aren't in church. These two and three have more in common than one and two. So again, it's in many ways, a person in church without a biblical worldview is more like a person who does not attend church. And you probably have had that experience as well. Maybe you've been at another church. Pastor Graham gave us permission to say that sometimes church is boring, okay? Some of us have probably been in churches that have been boring, okay? You probably had a situation where you're talking about somebody and you say, oh, he goes to church, and you're going, your friend goes, no, this person cannot be a churchgoer the way he acts in the business world. I mean, I've dealt with him. He's dishonored. There's no way that he's, you know, and you recognize even in our own church sometimes and in other churches, you go around and go, you know, some people are really serious about this and others are just here. You know what I mean? And so this is why we began to understand that having a biblical worldview was even more important than getting a person to church. The survey also asked, well, okay, how did the millennials have their influence? What was the millennials' influence? And found that most of the millennials, in various survey questions we asked, received their spiritual beliefs from their parents. Interestingly enough, I hate to tell this to any youth pastor, but the parents are much more important in the spiritual growth and nurturing of the kids than the youth leader is. Interesting, very much the case. But what that meant is that if the parents had inconsistent beliefs about God or Jesus and the Bible, then they passed those on to their kids. So if the parents had captive beliefs, guess what? Their children adopted that same secular belief. So first of all, we looked at worldview, but then you also want to look at a couple of other issues. Where do they make their decisions? How do they make their decisions? And this is where we saw this striking difference, because born-again millennials with a biblical worldview and who attend church regularly, that first group, they're more likely to look to a biblical source in making their decisions. Does that make sense? If you believe the Bible is the Word of God, you're going to make decisions that. If you move to those who attended church regularly but did not have a biblical worldview, only a third. You see the drop-off from, I use the Bible, to one-third. They're both in church, but look at the difference between having a biblical world and not having a biblical worldview. Dramatically different. By the time you get to the non-church attenders, it dropped off the charts. So again, we began to see that it wasn't just getting a person into church. It's actually beginning to believe those important elements of the Christian life. Then, how did we, as we began to follow those individuals, how did they respond to some of those biblical beliefs? So this is a series of questions. We ask them if they believe the Bible is true. Also ask them if they believe the Bible is consistent with science. And number three, if they try to follow it. And once again, you see that half with a biblical worldview accepted these three statements, everybody else drops off. And so now you begin to see the numbers getting smaller and smaller. So then we move from biblical beliefs to cultural practices. If you ask questions, for example, if they've engaged in immoral or inappropriate behavior, illicit sexual activity, anger, selfishness, and we found that those who were captive, those in 2 and 3, were less likely to even feel guilty about that. About one-third had no guilt at all about their sexual indiscretions. A couple weeks ago, I talked about how, you know, the baby boomers, they knew where the line was, and when they crossed over, they did it with defiance. With the captive Christians and millennials, they don't even know where the line is sometimes and don't even feel guilty about that. And so let me, in the interest of time, give you the summary. And that is, if we looked at those individuals who were born again, they had a biblical worldview, and they had at least a consistent set of religious practices. That is, they occasionally prayed, they occasionally read their Bible, they went to church. We went from all the born-again millennials down to 14%. That's just amazing. 14%. Then if you add to that those who also had a biblical worldview, some minimum biblical practice, and also held to some biblical cultural beliefs about abortion, sex outside of marriage, science and faith, you were down to 2%. Brothers and sisters, that is not a good sign for the future of the church in America. 2% of born-again evangelicals fit into that category. And this, I think, illustrates the great challenge we have for the church in the future, because if this continues down, if this plays itself out, the church that we have today may not be around 20 years from now, or if it does, it may not be as vital. The Christian ministries we support right now, they may not exist 20 years from now, or if they do, they may not have the same vitality they have now. The mission organizations that we have right now may not exist or may not have the vitality they have right now. You cannot build the future of the church on 2%. Are you ready for a revival? I certainly am. But this is one of the reasons why we put together this Periscope program, because it was really an attempt to try to put together a 7-week sermon series, videos, and readings. We're going through right now in the examine class, the small group studies. We're watching videos. We're reading through the book each week and all sorts of things. A CD that goes with it as well, because we want to have music and all the other resources to really create kind of a 49-day journey to really have a transform life. Now, I might say there is one other group, the interesting left, that's doing something similar, and that is the individual that co-teaches with Max Lucado. Randy Frazee has put together a series, not quite as long, but he also has come to the conclusion that you have to bring the whole church and a whole small group together and have some kind of integrated program if you're going to bring about the kind of change necessary. And, of course, that's exactly what is inside the church. If you go to our probe website, you'll see that, you know, we talk about the important, first of all, to be filled with truth, because one of the areas where there's a very significant drop-off is that we have a generation that no longer believes in absolute truth, that something is absolutely right or absolutely wrong. You know, it's kind of, well, you have your view of truth and I have my view of truth and someone else has a different view of truth. That's called postmodernism or moral relativism. You have your set of ethics, I have my set of ethics, you have a different set of ethics, and we have to come back to that. And next week we're going to spend some time working our way through Colossians 1 and 2 and talk about who Paul addressed in his day and how those false philosophies caused people to be captive and how some of those ideas still are found today in the 21st century. The number two, that Christ is the source of truth. I left this one out, but the one that makes my teeth ache is to recognize that as we did a survey of born-again millennials, a very high percentage of them agreed with this statement. It is possible for a person to be saved by the teachings of Jesus Christ or Muhammad or Buddha. In other words, there are many ways to the top of the mountain, many paths to the top of the mountain. Well, that kind of undercuts missions and it kind of undercuts evangelism, doesn't it? Then number three, the world cannot add to the truth. In other words, this idea that indeed we are complete in Christ. The idea that some people have this idea that I believe the Bible, but I add things to it. And this week when I was driving around with Dr. Gary Cook at DBU, he showed me where they have a number of their students that come from Korea and from Taiwan and from China and others, and then also those from India. And he said something interesting. It was really striking. He said, you know, when I have the students from Asia, a good number of them become Christians, and we've seen a remarkable change in their lives. The students I get from India, especially if they've got a Hindu background, they say they accept Jesus, but then they say they pray to everything else. In other words, Jesus is just one more God they add to the pantheon. And so I began to realize how it looks like some of those Indian students at DBU are Christian, and they go along with it, but they don't really understand that they're using kind of the gospel plus. As well, we see the idea that we need to walk in truth. We need to not only be able to think biblically, but we need to act biblically. And here is when we started to apply these things about biblical practice and cultural practice, that those were issues of the case. And then finally, of course, the one that we've been talking about, this idea of eternal perspective. You know, I'm a citizen on earth, but I'm also a citizen in heaven. And that's why I think it is absolutely essential to have that. So anyway, the program that we've had is we have what is called a Periscope Church Assessment Program, where we actually have questions that a church can use to begin to evaluate whether or not an individual is culturally captive. I guess we could make a link and you could go through it yourself if you wanted to evaluate yourself on those. But this is to help pastors and church leaders. And when we've done this, since I got a good friend at Cleburne Bible Church, I guess I can tell that story. Cleburne Bible Church, individual I've known for decades, man that actually used to teach Old Testament at Dallas Seminary and teaches a great series. When they did the church assessment, it was striking that in a Bible church where they've been hearing God's word for many years, still a highly significant number were showing up as culturally captive, even at Cleburne Bible Church. Now, to be fair to him, they had, what was it, a tornado down there a couple of years ago, and there was one church that went down, and so some people in that church came and joined Cleburne Bible Church. But even inside some of these Bible-teaching churches, you can find people that aren't believing biblical ideas and applying biblical principles. Matter of fact, I shared last week when I showed one of the videos that when they saw this, one couple saw that this couple had been living together, and they decided to stand for Christ and live separately, and then only live together after marriage, they go, you mean you're not supposed to live together before marriage? So even at the Bible church, you had some of those thinking about those issues. Then the 49-day church program, and of course what we're doing right now in the meeting that we have at the Black's House every Sunday night at 5 o'clock is the small group study, which is a video-based, discussion-driven type of conversation. And if you want to join with us, that is certainly one of the things that we are doing as well. Real quickly, if you are curious about the book, and I guess what, we'll make available some books for anybody that wants to come forward today. But in the book, what we try to do is cover all those key issues. Number one, the first week of seven various chapters looks at the whole issue of the fact that we are should be living for eternity and should have an eternal perspective. Next 7 weeks, we found that one of the biggest drop-offs also was is a lot of individuals do not believe in Satan. They do not believe in a spiritual war. And you know what? You're not going to be victorious in spiritual warfare if you don't even know that you're in a war. So that's why those seven chapters in the second week all have to do with the source of deception. Third week deals with exposing false views, and we're going to cover a little bit that next week, because where did these views come from and what is taking us captive in the 21st century? Some of the same ideas that were taking the people that Paul was writing to in the first century who were being taken captive. Then false living, how we need to recognize the dangers from the world, the flesh, and the devil. And then the idea of how to avoid cultural captivity. The sixth week, looking at how we should renew our minds and begin to make sure that we're thinking biblically. And then finally, living in community and knowing how to proclaim truth and the gospel to others. And so this is something that we've tried to make available in a small group format. Also, we have full orchestration and music and all sorts of things, because we're absolutely convinced that this is the challenge that we face. So next week, we're going to spend some time looking at some of these other very important principles so that we can make sure that we are not culturally captive, but we're living for Jesus Christ. Parker?